Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. On today's episode, I'm joined by coach Natasha van der Merwe from NVDM Coaching. Natasha, welcome back to the show and how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great, thank you. So glad to be back. It's been a while since we had a conversation, so excited to join you.
Yeah, I checked. It was April 2022, so it was a while ago. I'll link that in the episode, of course, for the listeners. And in that episode, we dove deeper into your background. You have a background in tennis, which was something we talked about, which was very interesting. And we talked about things like your coaching philosophy, training principles, etc. But for today, instead of doing that, we have a couple of main topics in store, and we'll take some listener questions as well. But is there anything else that we should discuss before we jump into our first question or our first topic for today?
No, I'm excited to have this conversation with you. Let's do it.
All right. So the first big topic is how to maximize training outcomes, training return on investment, let's say on a limited time budget. And we'll be using 10 to 12 hours for the purpose of this episode as an example. Or I guess if there is a particular reason, we can throw in other examples as well. But let's take that as our template for today. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I've actually been fortunate enough to be in this position where I have athletes that have 10 to 12 hours and they want to qualify for Kona, go like a low 9-hour Ironman. How do we maximize that time that they have available to train? And it starts with, I'm sure like yourself, Mikael, like excellent communication, because most of my athletes are remote. And so every single week they are laying out specifically exactly how much how much time they have every day. And honestly, it changes every single week because of their travel for the most part. And so me getting as much of an understanding in that ahead of time, and then from there, it's an understanding of what are the athlete's needs as well as, okay, what are the goals to get that. Example, one of my athletes did like a low 9-hour Ironman in his 50s. Off training 10 to 12 hours a week. And so he was a great swimmer. So an understanding like, okay, we don't actually have to allot specific time for the swim for him, because we could swim 3-4 times a week, or we could swim 2 times a week. He was still probably going to get the same outcome. So again, like a lot of my answers are, it's going to be, it depends, but it's really understanding and looking at what like that specific athlete needs. For another athlete, however, there's a certain amount of frequency that we're trying to hit on each discipline. And I am big about frequency. And so the only way to make it work in like a time-packed schedule is you have to double up where you can. So I know when someone is going to go to the swim, instead of swimming the 4K swim, hey, we're just going to maximize 2.5K. But it's also, we're at the gym, we're going to make sure that we're getting in and we're doing some strength training or some ability like while we're there, only if it's 30 minutes. And so that's how we do one thing. And then the same thing when it goes to the bike and the run, understanding how much we need to hit of each discipline, be it 3 times a week, 4 times a week, and then condensing the sessions and saying, okay, we're going to take out essentially maybe a warm down. If this person still needs to keep a warm up in order to be very effective in the main set that we're attacking, but we need some time to get out and do the run. So again, we can hit the frequency of all those markers that we're trying to achieve. And then, you know, as it pertains to how can we maximize the sessions itself, it's being really spot on with what is the goal of the session and the athlete understanding that, as well as making sure the zones are correct. I see that all the time where athletes will come into me and they only have so much time available, but they're not even executing on those sessions in order to make the gains they want from that session. So making sure every workout they're doing, we're hitting exact, you know, goals or targets within that workout, but then giving them autonomy to adjust that workout that they're currently doing. If they see that it's supposed to be threshold and the effort is not threshold, the heart rate is not threshold. And I'm like, okay, we only have so much time. You need to go ahead and up your power, or you need to go and adjust these things, right? That's another way. And then the other thing is just like, all the toolbox things that you can bring into the sessions in order to make quick adaptations. So depending if what the athlete can handle, so can they handle throwing in some specific big gear work? You know, can they handle throwing in more intensity and then recover from that intensity? You're going to make more adaptations from that time available as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, because I kind of pinged all over with different examples of things that I look at to maximize that time.
I mean, I think the first point there about really understanding the schedule is key to everything, because if you have a fairly limited amount of time, especially for the Ironman, like you mentioned in the examples, then yeah, you want to know exactly what you can do and what you can't do. And ideally you want to, I think there's also value in, even if it changes due to travel and so on, I have some athletes that where it doesn't change so much. So then there's value in like really focusing on trying to figure out what is the optimal base week template that we can set up the microcycle structure, and yeah, try to get the most out of that, because then also the athlete becomes more efficient in going through that. If you always have that, let's say swim plus gym on a Monday, you learn how to make the transition from swim to gym 5 minutes instead of 10 minutes, that sort of thing, when you just get used to it. So that's something that I would add. Yeah, I think the zones and executing correctly, that's another good point. But I think it goes both ways, because I also think a lot of athletes tend to do things a bit too hard sometimes. So yeah, it definitely goes both ways there. And I would say not falling into the trap of doing the easy training too hard, because for me, I would still want to try to maximize what we get out of the key sessions. But then sometimes when the reason that you're time limited is usually that you have other things going on. It's that you have work or you have family and both of those things, and they create a sort of stress in your life that is also a stress that will impact your ability to adapt to the training. So my preference would then be to still keep the easy training fairly easy, not really in the first. It's basically more of a last resort for me to try to increase the intensity of the easy training, and rather focus on getting more out of the harder sessions. But that being said, I'm totally with you. I do also use things like adding some torque work to endurance rides, that sort of thing. So it's more doing it slowly over time, and so that you know that, okay, the athlete has adapted to a certain level of stress. Because if you suddenly make the athlete ride at 70% of FTP every single endurance ride, that can be a recipe for disaster. But if you do it on one ride, one-hour ride, instead of 55-60%, you go to maybe a few 10-minute reps with high torque at 70-75%. That's a reasonable progression that they can probably do, and then over time build up to something more. So those are a few more things. I think I have more things as well that I could that I could jump into, but throw the ball back to you there if other things came to mind for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were spot on in saying that you only add if you need to add, you know, in so many ways, the principles are exactly the same of a person that has 15, 16 hours. I mean, you have a different, a specific philosophy that you follow, and you can track that this athlete is progressing based on the data points coming in, right? It's so easy. It's only once they stop progressing to where what their goal is, then you say, okay, maybe let's try add this in or try add that in. And then also the only way you're going to know if someone cannot recover from a session is by adding that extra session. So for example, I have some people that if we do an intensity session on Tuesday, well, I have to have them go easy on Wednesday. There's no way that they could do two hard back-to-back days. Whereas I have other people that can do 2 to 3 hard back-to-back days. And then their resilience is just so good. And a lot of it is also like the execution on the small little details of making sure they're going in fully prepared for the workouts. Their stress is low. Their fueling is like dialed in. Like all these low-hanging fruit things to maximize those sessions, like they're doing it already. And then from there, it's like, okay, this person can handle that stress or they can't handle that stress. And we just have to look at other ways in order to get what we need in. The example of the Ironman, I think you just have to work back and say, what are the key sessions? You know, what are we trying to achieve here? And working back. And so if I only have 12 hours, well, we have to make sure that in order for them to be physically and mentally prepared, this long bike needs to be in there. And ideally, we want to get them as specific to the goal, power, heart rate, you know, fatigue that they're going to experience on race day. And then you have everything else kind of supporting around that to make sure that they can execute on that session that's going to help them feel, you know, race ready. Yeah, I think same goes for the swim and the run. And then also an understanding, I'll give an example, like, yes, the swim is not as important for some people, right? But I think it's really important because it affects the rest of your race. But so you have to look at the athlete and go, okay, can this person execute, not be affected by the swim? of 2 swims a week, you know, they can still go and bike and run to their fitness level that they've created. Then this athlete over here, unless they're swimming a decent amount, the bike and run training is not going to benefit them at all if we really push that side of it, because they're going to be so fatigued coming out of the water that they're not going to be able to hit that desired power. And so in this case, for this person, we really have to emphasize the swim and be okay maybe letting go some hours on the run, like that lost discipline, that some small changes one makes such a big difference, right?
Yeah, I think with the swim, you can afford to really dial it back and kind of make it a much lower priority if you have at some point in your career built up to a decent swim where it doesn't affect your bike and run so much, because you have a bit of, you have that base in you still for quite some time. So then you can get away with much less. But if you're building up to an Ironman or something from scratch, then I do think you have to prioritize it still, even though it's the smallest part of the race, because like you said, otherwise it is going to so significantly impact the bike and the run. But speaking of the Ironman specifically, so I'm curious, in those examples that you have, how has the distribution been between, well, how do they get in the long workouts essentially? Do they, on 10 to 12 hours, do they still have, I don't know, 4 hours for a ride on a Saturday and 2 hours for a run, and then just 6 hours during the week? Or do you have also examples of athletes that don't even have that 4 hour block, so you have to make do with 3 hours or 2.5 hours, and then you have maybe a few weeks before the race where you can go a little bit longer?
Yeah. So for me, we've always been able to get in the weekend long stuff. I think most people that are kept by a schedule, it's their Monday through Friday, you know, their regular work schedule where they've got an hour, right? Mm. And then on the weekend, they can still get that 4, maybe 5 hours. However, how I manage the stress is if we are going in and doing a Saturday big bike workout of 4 hours, for example, well, the next day on the run, we are actually doing less hours on the run. We're not trying to build up the run volume and build up the run hours along with building up the bike hours. And so, example, let's just say we have 6 hours, 4 hour bike, 2 hour run. That makes up our 6 hours for the weekend. Well, the next weekend, we might do 3 hour, not that I do a 3 hour run quite often with my athletes, I don't, but we might do a 3 hour bike ride, be very specific with our goals within that bike ride. So the stress is almost the same, because it's like, yes, 3 hours, but there's a lot of specificity in that session. But then the next day, they're doing the 3 hour run. And so we have those up, down weeks. And I feel like by doing that, athletes are able to go from that weekend and roll into the week just as normal, versus them carrying this massive fatigue from the weekend. And then we go over our hours anyway. So it's just like managing the distribution of hours.
Yeah. One thing that I've found to be quite effective, maybe you can't do it into the build of an Ironman necessarily, because you do need to get those longer runs. But if you're training for any other distance, doing a bike on a Saturday and a Sunday and making the most of your weekend hours that way, just maximizing, using all the hours you have, do 2 bike rides, or maybe one long bike and one medium long bike with a brick run off of it, just to make use of all the available time you have. And then perhaps you can fit in a 90-minute run midweek. And for a 713, that would be perfectly adequate to do just that. And for the most part of your general preparation into an Ironman, and maybe you switch things around when you get into the final 8 to 12 weeks before the Ironman and start to build up the long run properly. But that's something that I found to work quite well.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think that we've done cycling blocks like that, and that really pushes things forwards in one discipline. And to speak to another thing, you know, we talked about where do we get to a roadblock, right? Where this athlete is not progressing anymore. And what I have found, just like you said, is where you dedicate time where we are going to focus on this discipline more so for a week or two or a block of training, maybe a whole weekend, that just pushes that fitness up in that discipline as we just maintain and sit around the others. And then, okay, we really want to make some progress on the swim. Same thing, you know, we're going to prioritize the swim this whole week, make that progress, make that jump as we maintain the rest. So it's in line with what you said there for sure. And then I don't know if you've also used this, but breaking up times. So I actually, when I was training personally, instead of sitting on the trainer for 5 hours, like I found it to be super effective where I did, you know, 2 hours very focused and intense, and then I would break, and then I could come back later in the day and I would do another 2 hours, like very focused. And I was able to drive a lot more intensity and focus into these shorter sessions versus sitting there and almost kind of wasting some time on some of these longer sessions, you know. And sometimes I do like three separate sessions like that in a day and get more quality out of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I use that as well, especially for more advanced athletes that have have a good resilience, good ability to do, for example, two more intense sessions during a day. I do like the a microcycle of, for example, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday doing doubles with some kind of intensity. And if you have an athlete that is able to tolerate, this is probably an athlete that is doing 12 sessions a week. So maybe slightly more hours than our 10 to 12 hours per week, probably more like approaching 15 hours. So no longer maybe in the same time crunch category, but that principle of breaking up sessions and doing doubles of intensity, I use that quite a bit also because of that allows you to then get in those days that are purely aerobic and where you don't have to, both physically you can recover, but also mentally you can recover from the intensity you did the way before. And for a lot of athletes, I think that works well. But I think, a certain base level of fitness is good. If you have people that are newer, maybe that's something that I do less of.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, another thing that is interesting to discuss when it comes to this is how to approach working on weaknesses versus strengths in a time-crunched scenario. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, is this weakness really going to affect my race, right? And then in the order of it, again, I think we mentioned about like if you have a really weak swim and you're going to be exhausted coming out of the water or it's going to take you 90 minutes, like it just puts you in a different time zone. I don't think people also realize that when you're coming out of the water, for example, and you're coming out in the 110 group versus you're coming out now in the 120, 125 group, how different the race is. Like now you're cycling with faster cyclists, you're kind of getting sucked along in that, and it totally like changes your day. You're also, that little shift, you're in this better group, you're maybe going to get off the bike sooner. It's like, okay, we're also getting out of the wind sooner, we're getting out of the heat sooner, and so now it's going to affect my run. So again, it's like, it's just so dependent on that athlete to where, again, with a time crunch schedule, you have to make the decision, A, can we improve enough through just shorter sessions because we only have so much time and we're maybe trying to get some other sessions in and get that frequency in? And if we're not doing that, then are something's going to give in that week for improving the swim? And then the other thing is what I just explained again, and it's called, block training, is are we in our buildup going to say, okay, we're going to do some focused swim blocks to try to push our swim forwards? And I usually utilize that in like our recovery days, recovery weeks. So maybe we've done 2 to 3 weeks of really great training and the athlete, it's natural for them to now need some time off the legs. Maybe they've just done a quality run. Okay, let's use these next 3-4 days to really focus in on the swim where we can apply the volume and the frequency and kind of push things forwards there. The bike, I feel, is so important, especially if we're looking at the Ironman. And so if you had to tell me, can you pick between the bike and the run, I'm going to say the bike every single time, because the strength and the fitness that can be gained from that, and we can really push the bike workouts even further without the chance of getting injured, that again, that fitness is going to carry over into that run, in that you're off the bike much sooner, that strength, endurance, that aerobic fitness, it's just going to carry over to the run. And so if we had to pick on giving away certain things, we'll go that direction. It's the very last thing that I will do with an athlete is identify the run as a weakness. And now we're going to drive a lot of our very limited training time into improving that run. I just feel like that is something that needs to be worked slowly, just because the level of the chance of someone getting injured, it just goes up as soon as you start to prioritize that you can't, microwave it, right? Everything else you can kind of microwave a little bit here and there, just get it done and push some fitness up, except for the run. It's a little hard to do, so.
This episode is brought to you by Precision Fuel Hydration. One of the best tools they offer is the free Fuel Hydration Planner that builds you a personalized strategy for any race, from triathlons of various distances to running, cycling, and swimrun events. They also have most of the Ironman and Ironman 73 races globally pre-built into the planner as the partner of Ironman globally. And their fuel options in terms of products range from PF 30 gels to PF 90 with 30 and 90 grams of carbs respectively. They have a caffeinated version of the PF 30 for an extra boost pre-race or mid-race. And if you're used to mixing gels into a concentrated carb bottle on the bike, like I used to do, then their Flow Gel is a brilliant alternative, which basically passes that strategy into the history books. The Flow Gel contains 300 grams of carbs. They also have drink mixes and a range of electrolyte products that you can match to your sweat sodium concentration. Check out all of this and the resources on precisionfuelhydration.com, and you'll learn to use a great balance of science and practice in your race nutrition hydration. And use the code TTS2026 to get 15% off your first order.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I mean, I totally agree with that. And I guess how I coach in this situation, it might change if somebody has to run as their strength. But I've thought about this and experimented with this for years. And it's one of those questions that I've grappled with. But my current thinking is that you definitely need to think about the limiters, like you said. If you're a 90-minute swimmer and you want to achieve a certain time in an Ironman, you might need to get to a 110. You might not need to get to a 1 hour, but you might need to get to a 110 for that to even be possible, both for the impact of on your physiology and your fatigue in the rest of the race, but also where you are in the race dynamics and so on, like you said. So there's one thing to identify the limiters, the pure limiters, but then you can still be a weaker swimmer, let's say a 110 swimmer compared to your run and bike, but it's a weakness, but it's not a limiter. So then my thinking is that I'd rather, with a time crunch athlete anyway, work on strengths, because the reason that it's a strength is probably a natural level of talent to some extent. And something that you're more talented at, you're going to have an easier time improving with less input, with less stimulus. Mm-hmm. So basically that's the thinking there, that you are probably able to improve your bike more on 5 hours a week if the bike is something that you're good at, you're talented at, compared to if the bike is something you're naturally not good at. So I would think about that as well. And if somebody has the bike as a clear strength, I would lean into that and try to push the bike even more, because they probably have we have an easier time to get closer to the potential in something you're talented in, even with less input. And I would do the same with the run, but definitely with more caveats on having to doing it carefully and progressively and not taking unnecessary risks there. But a lot of times as well, people that are talented runners or have the run as their strength. If you have the run as your strength, then you might not have had too many issues with the injuries, because that tends to, even if you're a talented runner, it tends to over time erode your strength in that discipline anyway, right? So it tends to be almost a natural selection there as well.
Yeah, no, I love everything you said there and spot on as well. Yeah, I mean, I really do think you have to look at it. And as you said, the example of the swim, well, they're a 110 swimmer. If we put in much more time here and it's going to be so hard for them to do, we're now going to be a 108 swimmer, right? There's a point of like, this extra work doesn't actually make sense at all. So we need to just be okay with that weakness, with where it is, make sure it doesn't hurt them. And then, as you said, drive the focus into where we can clearly see room for improvement.
Yeah. Well, let's get to something that I'm sure a lot of listeners are asking, which is, how much intensity can you do? Let's say you are somebody who's working towards a low 9-hour Ironman. So you're clearly, you've been doing it for a decent amount of time doing the sport. You have a good level of fitness. How much intensity would you give an athlete like that, that has 10 to 12 hours a week to train?
As much as they can recover from, if I'm being honest. Yeah. So it's so dependent on the athlete. You know, a lot of the times, well, someone will come in and they haven't built that foundation to withstand the training. Like, that training load of 10 to 12 hours already is a lot. So it's like, it's a stress that they have to have been used to for a while successfully. And they're managing it with the stress of work, of their busy life schedule, But then everything else, like they're nailing their nutrition, they're nailing their sleep, and we can identify and say, okay, let's start to add a little more stress than what we're used to. And so the only way to do is to try, because I think there's a physical limitation of them being able to hit the session, but there's also more so a mental limitation that we have to take into account of, like, every day they're like hitting it hard. And so, yeah, again, some athletes, they can roll in from an intense, like a Tuesday, having a very high quality bike, maybe a faster run off. And the next day they can roll around, they can turn it over and they can do still the quality run and maybe a quality swim. And then yes, by Thursday, we need to back it off. I have some athletes that can turn it around and still recover on Thursday and still do that. And so it has to make sense. You have to be looking at it, are they truly recovering and handling the load of what we're asking them to do? And then are they progressing off that? Because there's one thing to do it. There's another thing to just create fatigue that's going to show up and they're not going to improve. But there's another to, like, each week you are seeing them improve. Now, what is common for what I can do with athletes, we can typically go hard on the bike, again, 2, sometimes 3 times a week. Again, the chance of injury risk is much lower, and so the tolerance is higher. On the swim, that is an area where you can handle a lot more intensity. However, I do like to make sure that if I am asking a lot from an athlete on a Saturday on their bike run, the day before they're going easy. Just, I think, this mental reprieve of not, like, having to get after it. Whereas before, I will say, because I laid out the week and identified, okay, we're coming off Thursday, which is more of an endurance day. Friday's a great day to hit it hard. Fast Friday, right? But what was the impact on Saturday for them? So I've almost shifted that to where I think, like you spoke, and I'd love to hear your voice, what you do, but let's keep the intense days intense, right? And so that might mean a hard swim followed by a hard bike, etc. And then they can recover and deload off that on easier the next day, but then be ready to roll again come Thursday. And then, yeah, I think I was saying on the different disciplines, the swimming, how many times we can go hard, you can go typically harder. I do twice a week. I feel like mentally that's about what people can absorb twice a week, even though physically they could probably handle more. 2, usual, sometimes 3 times a week on the bike. And then the run, that's where it's so dependent on the person. For sure, 1 times a week, we are hitting, you know, an intensity session, especially for someone trying to go 9 hours in an Ironman off this time allotted. So, you know, be a threshold, tempo work, etc. But then as we get closer to the race, you can bet that there's going to be a session where they're running harder off the bike to get used to that. And if we're not doing that within their long run, we are making sure that they are running at the desired pace, effort that they're going to expect to run on race day and get that feeling for it. And so now you're looking at 2 kind of harder runs and then easier, shorter runs around that.
Yeah, and that race pace run for a longer race, for an Ironman at least, that might, in a physiological sense, it might be classified as a low intensity session almost, but it's not really when you're doing it for a long duration and you're right at that kind of LT1 intensity and especially under fatigue from the rest of the training. So yeah, definitely, and perceptionally that's a harder run as well. But yeah, I think I like what you said there about it, like, as much as you can recover from and absorb, and it's an experiment to see what's possible. I think there is a bit of a tendency in the triathlon, in the endurance sports world in general, to create rigid rules that are not really helpful, that you have to do an 80-20 distribution, or you have to do, but it goes both ways, right? So it can be people limit themselves from how much hard training they can do, but it can also be people think that they have to do 2 hard bikes, 2 hard swims, when for a lot of people, it's more than enough to do 1 of each. And in some cases, it might be 0. So it really depends, and you have to figure out what is the best way for you and based on your goals and where you are at the moment. But yep. Yeah, I think that's a good, basically a good point that you made, that as much as you can recover from and absorb, you have to see that you're able to progress and become stronger. But I'm also aware of quite a lot of athletes that have done really fast times across different distances with a limited amount of training that have
leaned quite heavily into doing quite a lot of what you would look at the program and see, oh, that's a pretty intense program. What people had to remember as well is that often comes off the back of 10, 15, 20 years in the sport and maybe having had more time in the past building up a base.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then on the flip side, people, especially when they're newer to the sport, they don't need any intensity. You can just be consistent. I've done blocks with athletes in the off season where we're literally just doing zone one into zone two and then top end zone two. The amount that they've improved without even touching intensity is truly insane, how they've raised things and then they've made themselves so durable to then what's to come. But I think especially the beginner triathlete, they do have a tendency to lean into too much intensity when literally they could just show up and do that endurance work well, consistently, frequently, and do amazingly well.
Yeah, definitely agree. And I also think that the type of intensity is different when you have the advanced athletes versus the beginner athletes. So like you said, you can start with zone one, building into zone two. And then, naturally, what comes after zone two, zone three. That's how I would approach it with a beginner athlete. Whereas for an advanced athlete, especially a time crunch one, zone three training might be specific for the race, but that's something that we're doing in the last few weeks before a race. And in your general preparation, when you're just trying to make yourself a fitter and better athlete, that's going to benefit you in any race that you're doing, regardless of the distance, then I wouldn't do much zone three training at all. It would be more zone four and zone five in a five zone model.
Right.
And maybe depending on how you define things, if you call something like sweet spot training high zone three, low zone four, I mean, it's right around there. That would be basically the lowest intensity that I think is useful for an advanced athlete in their general preparation as opposed to the specific preparation. But for a beginner athlete, again, doing things at 75% of FTP, 80% of FTP, really good stimulus, because the stimulus that is needed is just so much lower.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah, I mean, I definitely, it's zone two or zone four, zone five in the general preparation is where we're working. And then yes, as we get into race pace, it's what is the demand of race day?
Yeah.
That's when you're adding in the zone three. So,
are there any other, let's say, time efficiency hacks that you see working other than the doubling up that you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I just am such a big believer that someone can go and work out for 90 minutes and not be fully focused on what they're doing. And then you can have someone who works out for 45 minutes and drive so much intention into what they're doing. They're focusing on their form, they're focusing on their breathing, they're practicing mental tactics in how to be engaged in the present moment, and they can get further along in their preparation for their race than someone kind of just like, going and doing 90 minutes. So I just think there's a lot to be said about driving intention into the 45 minutes you have. Going to the pool, what are you focusing on? Specifically with your form, and how is that going to translate into what you're going to hold on race day? What are those go-to cues? And then the sets, you being very specific about the interval that you're hitting and trying to hold and understanding what is happening in your stroke in order to hold that late in the set versus someone just going and swimming. So I just, just a big believer in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that brings me to one other point that I think that I've seen where things maybe go wrong sometimes is with the execution. And I think, so this is one, always a popular topic, right? Should you use your Garmin in the pool? Personally, I'm not against that at all. I do that as well. But what I really see as not working at all is when athletes load their workout onto their Garmin and just follow that guided workout, because then you don't get all the information that was in the original description. So the original description might have said 10 times 200, every second one bilateral breathing, every second one, and then alternate breathe left, breathe right. You're just going to see 10 by 200 on your Garmin. There are so many examples of that you're going to just miss. Other cues that are in the description that you're not seeing when you're... So just print out a paper, stick it to a kickboard or a water bottle or whatever you have, and that's going to really make your swimming better. And from my perspective, yes, absolutely fine to record the swim on the Garmin, but just don't put the structured workout in there and follow it from your Garmin. That's something that I think is a complete waste of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's so funny. It brought me to a thought. I had an athlete that it was loading into their form goggles, but in every single swim workout, I would write a goal for like, that's it, just like you said. And he said, please take all the writing out. Like, I just want to know what the set is. I'm like, well, that is
the purpose of it.
Not the point, you know, like we are trying to, for example, I think the set was like descend the pace, you know, or start, you know, hard 50 into race pace 50. And so I was describing that and try doing so this way and try doing so that way. Again, having very specific cues in what you're trying to do and how that's going to translate to your day. For me, I have a hard time with the watches, Mikael, because I teach athletes and I have a lot of new athletes in the pool. And as they're pushing off, they'll hit their watch and they'll push off and they just push off in such a bad position after hitting their watch that I teach, if you have a really good streamlined push off, it sets you off with really great body position, really great core tension. For your stroke, you are focused right away. And that always like throws them off. And then them coming into the wall and the first thing, instead of closing hard and they're doing specific sets, the first thing that they're kind of slowing down and hitting their watch, it's just kind of this added distraction. So as much as I can, I try to lean people away from using their watch. And then also, I love a base interval. Like when you can learn how to read the clock and keep yourself consistent, like, okay, I have to come in 120 every time. That's my goal race pace. Learn how to lock that in. And I'm going to leave on the 140. There's something about that base that keeps you honest versus 20 seconds rest. Because all of a sudden you come in at 125 and now you're 145 and you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. And I see that as a lot with if it disrupts your swimming, your push-offs or your approach to the wall, then I don't like watches anymore. I tolerate them when they're not disrupting any of that. So that's more where I stand, because I know a lot of athletes like them, and well, I do fall into that category myself. But I tend to think that I can do the push off without it actually affecting me, because I press start before and press finish after. But it is terrible though when you see in a squad swim, especially, you see one person stopping to swim before they approach the wall and to stop the lap, and then everybody else gets stuck behind that. So in a squad swimming situation, when we do training camps and so on, there's very often we remove the watches from people because it's just better that way. But yeah, no, I think your points are very, very well made. Another execution factor that I've seen, which makes workouts go awry a bit, is when athletes do their training on their bike training on Zwift, and they might have their FTP set differently in Zwift than in Training Peaks. And obviously the coach doesn't typically have access to their Zwift account, so can't check or confirm that. And then the athlete might just assume that whatever Training Peaks pushes out is going to be the same as it is in Zwift, but actually Training Peaks pushes, or whatever platform you use, pushes the percentages and not the raw powers. So if you have a different threshold FTP setting in Zwift, then you might do a different workouts at a different level. And it's one of those unnecessary mistakes that is going to not make you make the most of your training and get the most bang for buck from it.
It costs you terribly. I see just this one thing alone is why people are not improving. They're not adjusting their power, because we have athletes who'll come in and train with structure and they will improve every session pretty much, to where it's like we're not waiting to test. We're looking at power to heart rate, to how they're feeling. And immediately I'm saying, next week, go in to Zwift. Let's up your FTP by 10 watts, because this workout, clearly you were not in the right zone for us to make specific adaptation from the session. We kind of wasted it a little bit. And then you get to, your goal is as a coach to give the autonomy to the athlete. Like if you are not working at what should be a threshold effort, your heart rate is not getting into this range, which aligns with that, you need to up your power within that session. Don't go 8x5 minutes, you know, zone 3, because we know we say we don't do that and it's supposed to be a threshold session.
Yeah.
Like immediately up your power because, again, you only have so much time. So you have to maximize that session. You got to make the changes within that session if you can.
Yeah. How do you give athletes that autonomy? Do you have RPE targets that you, or is it more that after you see the workout come in, you analyze it, you see that, okay, next week, do this? Or do you also give athletes a target, a more of a three-dimensional target of it should be this power, but also this RPE, this heart rate, and then you triangulate between the three of them?
Yeah, you try to educate them in this. This is what your number should be across the board, and this is where your effort should be across the board. At first, you're just taking in the information, and then you're giving them feedback. But then as you're giving them feedback, you're saying, well, I'm seeing at 200 watts, last week your heart rate was 160, and that is in range with zone 4. But this week your heart rate is 155. So just know that in the future, if you are not going to get into what should be zone 4, I want you to go ahead and up your power because that is the range. So it's just educating the athlete through that data that's coming in. And guiding them to make those adjustments, to trust those adjustments. And the same goes on the flip side too. Like they might be starting a workout and they're supposed to be in zone 2 and their heart rate zone 4 for the day because of the stress that they're carrying in. You know, we might say, okay, if that is the case, this today might not be your day. And instead of pushing through, let's back off. Let's turn it to a zone 2 day, give me the feedback. And then obviously you're maybe getting sick, too much stress. And then we can decide, okay, we missed that session. It was a key session for the week. We don't have another hard workout coming our way for another week based on the schedule we have. Maybe let's move this or, hey, let's just move on. Let's get you feeling better. Let's give it a go again next week. So that's why I honestly program 1 week at a time. So like I have the framework, but I never go beyond 1 week at a time because what happens this week fully affects what happens next week based on how they executed things, what their power to heart rate numbers are that I'm staying on top of every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when you said there about the heart rate, if it being lower and you increasing the, I'm sure you also take RPE into account though, that RPE being, because if RPE is higher and your heart rate is lower, then you're probably getting into some, at least fatigue, maybe a bit of functional or non-functional overreaching. So.
Yes. No, absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that because most don't know that there is a difference, right? They just see the heart rate dropping and they think they're getting better. But in some cases, that's not the case. So we definitely have to pay attention to that as well.
And that's why as coaches, we want RPE ratings from athletes on every single workout.
I don't know about yourself, but we encourage every workout has to have a comment.
Yeah.
And literally, if they're not commenting, we're not commenting. So it's like, if you want me to go in and analyze your workout every single day, you need to give me more. I can't, just seeing the data points is not the whole picture. I need more here. So
yeah, definitely. No, I same thing. RPE and smiley feeling. Yeah. How did you feel? Basically, the way I describe it is, what was your performance compared to the expected? Because you can feel great even if it's a very hard session. It can be the hardest session that you've ever done, but you feel great because you thought that you weren't going to be able to do it and you did it. So you put like the smiliest of smileys there. And it's the performance compared to your expectations there. So that and the RPE and the comment. And I might not have a formal no comment from you, no comment from me, but I mean, in practice, it often ends up being that because it's not that I begrudge giving a comment if I don't get a comment, but it's just, I just didn't get the complete picture. So what can I say? I'm a bit in the dark of what that session was like. And it happens on easy sessions mostly. And then it's fine. It's not a big deal, but I do things pretty similarly there, I would say.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's, you know, we're coming in trying to do the best possible job for this athlete. And in order to do so remotely, you need all the information. So the more communication, the better. You know, I've even started doing, and it's so funny, I'm sure you have this, but you work with different athletes and you learn different things. And I've started doing further and like question asking for our athletes about their day. And she will be totally okay for me to give her a shout out. But I've started to working with professional triathlete Lydia Russell, who's new in the 70.3 scene. And from her college days, they used to do this thing where they call it high-low buffalo, which is what was your high for the day? What was your low for the day? And then give me something random, you know, just to get to know you. And my athletes love filling that out every single day because to your point of in that high, they were like, I did the session. I didn't feel like I could do the session. And so there's even like a little more in depth to, you know, what they went through that day versus just those comments to that workout. And then the low might have been like, oh, I messed up fueling. I'm so mad I did that because I totally felt that on the run. And then the buffalo might be just something that you further develop the relationship, which is super cool. And then It just creates a little more buy-in for both sides. And it. And then the other thing we started doing is just like weekly recaps. I'm sure you do this with your athletes as well. It's something we've tried to do in the past, but now we literally put it in Training Peaks for them to fill out and we have it all formatted for them where they can go in and they can talk about like their wins for the week and their biggest takeaways. And then the most important thing, which I think is so helpful, is next week. What are you going to do better? Like, where did you feel like you didn't quite hit the mark or you totally failed? And by them writing it down, it's a real thing and it keeps them accountable to me. And so, again, communication being key so that I can properly do my job and the investment of time and money and energy that you're putting in is now being met, you know, and rewarded in hopeful, you know, improvement.
Yeah, no, I love that. I don't do it formally in that way, more informally in calls, but I think that that's a great idea. And I also loved high-low buffalo. That's a funny one, but I totally see how that can be really valuable because I do think that you can have more success as an athlete when you and your coach have, you know, a bit more than just a professional relationship in a way. Like, that's not to say that you have to be best buddies, but you have to feel like you have some reasonably good connection, and I think that that's something that can help with that to really maximize what you can get out of the coach-athlete relationship. Yeah. Great. But what are the typical things that you, when you start working with an athlete, that they might find continuously that they maybe not execute properly on and that they then start to improve by actually doing this analysis, this and giving this feedback and having these sorts of discussions?
Yeah. So the first then one that came to mind before you said analysis and feedback was just the fueling. And that is something that they put in their comments as well. But it's amazing how many people it's second thought. And so I actually, when I start working with athletes, I will say like, okay, I always say we want to meet you where you are, right? So I'm going to look at what you've been doing before and the schedule that works for you. And we're going to start there and then show me how you've been fueling. And put the notes in. And then, okay, from what products, what amount? And then I'm going to give suggestions and say, okay, let's try this. And then can we make the switch in the schedule? I know you've been used to this with your family life, et cetera, but maybe this might be more efficient for us. And so number one is just getting on top of very specific fueling for every session. And even for a lot of athletes, like we are writing that in their session. This amount of carbs. I know Fuelin does that right now as an example that ties to Training Peaks, but we're doing that for our athletes as well. And then I think outside of that with the back and forth on the comments, again, we've been speaking about this for the last 20 minutes. It's just like really being able to dial the athlete having awareness of the effort and the intensity of every single session and dialing things in accordingly because someone can go along and be hitting the workouts. And for some reason this week, the stress is just too much and they don't do it. And I can't tell you how many times an athlete will push through because it's on the paper and they shouldn't be pushing through, you know? And so we've probably warded off so much injury because of that continual communication and awareness of what this should feel like. So.
Yeah. Oh, great answer.
How about you?
I think it's a big picture thing, but how athletes start to go easier on their easy days and either harder or at least doing more hard work on their hard days, either one of those two, it more often than not, it might be not necessarily higher intensities, but it's just that at least if we talk about intermediate to advanced athletes, but they might have been doing tiny sessions, 4 by 4 minutes at threshold, and now they'll be progressing up to 10 by 4 minutes, and some advanced athletes even more than that. So
basically I would say polarizing the training more. Hard days hard, hard workouts hard, easy workouts easy, but still with intensity control. So for some athletes that's a difference, but I don't think that that's so common. I don't see actually so many athletes that are coming in and always going all out on their sessions. That's less normal. But I definitely see a lot of athletes that go too hard on their easy days, and a lot of athletes that actually don't understand that they can push quite hard. And in some cases, also, like you said, being afraid to do intensity with relatively high frequency. That's another thing, and realizing that they can actually do that. So those would be the main things. It's around intensity at both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, for some reason, you know, I was thinking about some of the data that I analyzed with athletes. And of course, you're looking at the basic data that we've been speaking about. But one we haven't spoken about is cadences, both on the run, both on the bike, and where are they? And trying to learn their optimum cadence and at different intensities. And then, okay, where does that translate to race day? And those are just like little easy wins of things to dial in, because I can't tell you how many people that they will train on the trainer and they'll sit and grind away at 75 RPM unless you tell them something. And then on race day, they'll go out and try to ride at 90 RPM and wonder why they can't do it. Their heart rate's through the roof. Their legs are not efficient to it. And that they need to align. There needs to be an awareness there, you know. And then, of course, you look at like the running. You know, when we have athletes come in, we always want to see form, you know, video from the front, from the side, from swim, bike, run, etc. But a lot of times you can look at the data and you go, okay, I need to see, you know, why is this, is it the run cadence so low? Are you overstriding? And then just finding, you know, what is going to work for them in order to increase efficiency and speed, et cetera. But yeah, that was just another like data point of like analysis and awareness that I feel like you can pay attention to and make improvements on, right?
Yeah. And I think, well, on the bike especially, I like to work. That's one thing that you can do as basically getting more out of your easier, your lower intensity rides. I like to work at both high and low cadences. Usually I do them in separate rides, but you might have one ride per week that is either dedicated to more high cadence work, and the next week it's dedicated to low cadence work. And it's all zone one, zone two work, but you're still working at usually that cadence work is zone two and sometimes even high zone two. But dedicating time to working at different cadences and improving your effective range of cadences. And then, I tend to just prescribe self-selected cadence, most comfortable cadence for racing. But when you have built up a bigger effective range, then the self-selected cadence is also hopefully going to be more efficient for you.
Yeah.
I have one other, or we do have one other big topic that I want to get to. So let's move to that one, which is related to this one. But at what point how do you figure out if you're already ticking all the boxes, there's not that much else that you can do, and you just really need to find a way to do more volume because you're essentially limited by the volume that you can put into training?
Yeah, I mean, I think you maximize, as you said, you try everything. You get creative trying everything, right? With these athletes that have only so much time. And then once you get to a point of not being able to progress, I would say at that point, you have to say, okay, we have to increase some volume. And, you know, if we really don't have more time, I'm more likened to say, okay, well, how do we increase the frequency, the interaction with what we're doing something to become more efficient at it within that time? And then after that, it's like, okay, can we sneak a little bit more time here and there and here and there? And it's like an added 10 minutes here and added 10 minutes there. All of a sudden, we've added two more hours that has really benefited us. But before that, you really have to say that I have tried everything and I've gotten extremely creative with the workouts that I'm giving my athletes to know that, right?
Yeah, basically everything. I mean, I think I think at some point, because I do know I can be a bit direct sometimes and say that you've done most of the things that are like the low hanging fruits and the middle hanging fruit. And maybe those like super out there things, it's not even worth trying, because I think I know that what you need is to do more volume. So then I might actually try to figure to squeeze in more volume before I go to some of those things. But how to do that? I mean, sometimes you can do that without it actually disrupting, without it feeling like you're doing more volume. So making sure that you're doing the typical recommendations of commuting as training, so cycling or running, commuting to your job, to the pool, if you're going to the pool, to the gym. So those sorts of things. But then, if you don't really have any more time in the week, then what I like to suggest is trying to do two training camps. They can be self-organized training camps in a year where you just take the week off and you do big volume. Because I think that can stay with you, especially if you do two of them during a year, it can stay with you really well throughout the year. And the goal of those weeks would just be to accumulate as much volume as you can, really. So a lot of that would be biking.
Yeah.
And the other one as well is a lot of athletes have sometimes the opportunity, or they're even forced to, they have too many vacation days that they need to take. So can you take maybe a midweek day, like take a Wednesday off every week for the next 8 weeks if you have 8 vacation days that you need to use? And let's make that a pretty big training day when your kids are at school, your partner is at work, and all of that, and you can just train. And a midweek is good. You could go either way. You could go Friday and then you have an extended weekend. But also you can make yourself pretty tired already on a 2-day weekend. So a midweek day is good in that sense that you spread things out a little bit more. You can do a big day in midweek and then 2 big days on the weekend. So those are a couple of ways that I would go about it. And then, I mean, the final stage to that is like if you don't do any of those things, or that's something that you can only do later on in the year, maybe you're 6 months away from being able to do a training camp, but you don't really have any ability to take any vacation days, then, I mean, the thing that at some point, I think it's also important to be honest, both as a coach and as an athlete with yourself. I'm in that situation now personally as an athlete that I'm very volume limited, and I have to be realistic with myself of what I can expect. And it's not, I can't be made the athlete that I was when I was training 20 hours, when I'm now training 8 hours. So I would also have that discussion with the athlete that, and it's, in some cases, the athlete realizes that, well, actually, my goal is so important that I figure out a way to get in an extra 2 hours. And it might just be a reprioritization of things. It might be that they realize that I love triathlon, but I have other hobbies as well, or other things that are important. And I'm very happy with what I have achieved with my current volume. And let's maximize the volume that I have, but with the understanding that maybe it's going to be a bit of a plateau, but doing things right can help me stay at this level and not decline. But I think it's important to discuss that as well, that there is, it's not always going to be an upward trajectory.
Yeah, 100% to everything you said. And I 100% agree about a massive training load staying with you for a long period of time. Just as you spoke about earlier in how you can maximize your weekend, go long on the bike on Saturday, turn around, go long on the bike on Sunday. Like, that can really push fitness forwards. And I did like what you had to say about when you're trying to figure out time to train more. At the end of the week, you need to assess, are you maximizing the time you have available, and do things need to move around? Because it's amazing how I have some athletes that will maybe do, this is their routine, swim Monday, and then they come back to the gym later and they do mobility, okay? But they actually realize they actually have more time in the morning if they want to. And so they'll do mobility and swim, get those sessions in, and now they have time in the afternoon to do an hour on the bike before dinner time, which sets their legs up really well for the next day, the quality bike workout, versus coming in with their legs flat. And now not only have you increased your volume on Monday, you've done way better on Tuesday because of that added preparation. So I challenge athletes to keep moving things around until you are like optimizing your time, and then optimizing your ability to execute on these key sessions as well. And these small little adjustments can make a huge difference.
Yeah. I think that a good exercise for anybody is to log your time for maybe a whole week, but at least a couple of days, like every single thing that you're doing, write it down in a on a piece of paper or in a spreadsheet or wherever it might be, and see where is your time actually going? Because there is very, and then you analyze it from as if you were an outside observer. What would an outside observer say about this? Or you show it to your coach, who is an outside observer, if you have a coach, and you can discuss that. Because quite often when you do that, you realize that there is still, you can still, that it doesn't mean that you're leaving tons of hours unused, but there are small tweaks that you can do perhaps that can help you get in a bit more training, and that can make a significant difference, especially compounded over time.
Absolutely. I do that for business, Mikael, where I will track my hours and then write down, like, for this hour, did a podcast. For this hour, I answered, you know, workout emails or whatever it may be. And there's something about, and there's actually, I'm sure, studies on it, because they've spoken about it, how when you just start recording your time, you immediately have that mindset of, I'm going to make the most of my time as well, versus it just kind of disappearing. So I love that idea for athletes to do that, because I've been doing that for work for a while, and it's been really, really helpful for me.
Yeah, I can't even tell you how many years I've been doing it for work, but it must be more than 5 years, probably coming up on 10 years, probably, that I track every single minute of my work. And yeah, it's helpful. You have to be a bit, sometimes I get a bit lazy with it even, and then it's just tracking. And tracking for tracking's sake is also not helpful. You have to have a look at it at some point to see for it to be helpful. But in the context of your training, most people are not really doing it in this way. So they're doing a short tracking period of a few days, and then you have the intention, and you take action on actually looking at it and assessing where your time is going. That can be really useful.
Absolutely. Yep.
Is there anything else on that? What about I guess that's one more point on that, though. When we are talking about, and then this goes for both the previous conversation on maximizing the time you have when you have a time limitation, and also maybe when you're trying to increase volume somehow. But how do you figure out that, actually maybe you're doing too much, where it'd be too much, you know, too much load overall, and you're not actually absorbing it? How do you realize that that's happening?
I mean, in the same right of, like, if we need more load because you're not progressing, right? If you need to change something up, if you're seeing the numbers just stay stagnant and there's no improvement. But yeah, you will know if it's too much, in the sense that the easy ones are like, you're gathering more fatigue and there's no improvement happening, right? You are showing up to your hard workouts and you're not able to execute on them is another one. Just overall mood is another one. So it's like, maybe you are still able to do the workouts, but you notice a shift in your mood, then it might be like, okay, this, I'm not handling the stress of this. And then we always look to, okay, why aren't you handling the stress? I always attack fueling first. If we increase your fuel a little bit more, is that going to be different? If we change your mindset going into this workout, like did a little bit of, like, what do we call it? Meditation work going in, and your mindset is calmer to be able to handle the load. Can we do that? Are you running, or are you cycling and your cadence is 70 RPM and it should be 90 RPM and now the muscular fatigue is too much and that's why we're not recovering? So you still look at the details of the workouts of why are you not recovering like that first, and all the added factors on the side. But then beyond that, it's like you try something, you realize it's too much, you pull back. And it's more likely done probably, I mean, it's always shown up on the run, right? Because someone clearly gets injured. And so if you're like, oh, too much volume, too much intensity, it's less shown up on the bike because...
But ideally, you would see that before you get injured. So.
Totally. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, on the bike, it's just like the legs, like the quads are not just like handling the load. You're showing up on your bike workout and they're just not, you know, not
heavy legs. Heavy legs and you can't get your heart rate up.
There you go. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, you stop progressing, you stop feeling good, you're moody, you know, all the things.
Yeah. I think motivation as well, motivation to train goes down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, you might be more grumpy. Ask your, if you have a spouse, then ask them if you have been more grumpy.
Yeah.
Recently. That can be a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's why, coming back to something we talked about, that the towards the start of the conversation as well, like building up from below, because then it's easier. Because if you're just, let's say that you're an athlete now, you signed up for an Ironman and you're starting training, and you take a program from the internet and you just start doing that, and you feel and you're not progressing. Maybe you have some athletic background. Well, how do you know if you're doing too much or not enough, especially when you don't have so much experience? It's not always that easy. But if you build things up from the bottom up and you start really, really easy, then you can almost guarantee that, well, you're not doing too much, and then you add a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. That's also why it's not the most exciting, because it's not that, you know, an Ironman in 3 months or 2 months or anything like that. But it's a smarter way and a more sustainable way of doing it. And even for same thing when you're coming back into a new season, starting with less and building up, so that you start with something you know you can actually handle.
Agreed. Yeah. It's a tough one as a coach, because it's not sexy and it's really simple. And you have an athlete who comes in, and you almost feel as a coach, you need to give them something that they cannot create on their own in order for them to make sense of them paying you to help them. And then we can go down the wrong path. When in reality, we have to, as we said, look at what they're doing. Okay, let's do that. At first, I like to actually do exactly what they have been doing. And now let's do this better. Let's fuel it better. Let's do it with maybe more efficient form. Let's pay attention to how we're going into these sessions. And so execution across the board is better. Okay, now let's add. And then now let's add.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's just a lot of patience up front, but it pays off in the long run in a big way.
Yeah. All right, let's go into some listener questions. I'll just pick a few that are related to the topics we discussed here today. Let's see. So there's several that we've already... here is one. Discipline layout in a 7-day cycle, including combining workouts for efficiency. So I guess microcycle structure and how to set that up.
Yeah. So I use two different cycles, Monday through Sunday. I'll go through 1 week and then I'll go through another week, slightly different. So, and it's based on the ability of the athlete. If they can handle more, this is what the second one looks like. So the first one that's pretty basic is like, I look at Monday as an active recovery day. We're doing a little bit of mobility. We're doing a recovery form swim because it's coming off a big weekend for most people. Come Tuesday, they're doing an intense bike workout. So it just depends on where you are in the build. And so that will dictate the workout done. And then we're usually doing like a run off. Same thing, it starts off aerobic, but then maybe as we get closer to the season, maybe we're starting to incorporate strides. Maybe we're starting to incorporate some race pace work off the bike. Wednesday, we're usually turning around that bike run workout with a specific run workout. And then I like the frequency of every other day on the swim for your average athlete, where they're swimming 3 times a week. And so they're following that up with a swim. So it's a swim run or run swim of intensity. And then come Thursday, you're ready to recover. And so we're saying, okay, now this is more of a zone 2 bike, but let's add the skill set of learning how to ride in aero, or maybe we're throwing in some different cadence work to build up efficiency at different ranges of cadence. Not ideal, but that's typically when we get in the gym. It just works for a lot of people on that day, because then on Friday, we're swimming. We might add in an easy jog again. We might add in an easy bike, really get yourself set up for the weekend. And then like most programs, there's a long bike ride on Saturday with some specific work in it. And then the run off also at times with some specific work in it. And then the run would be the long run. And same thing, can be just aerobic miles and building that volume, or we're going to have some specific work in that. A lot of my top better athletes, they're swimming on that day as well, using it as active recovery, but just another day to get in the pool. And then the second version, and then I'll turn to you if we have time for it, but the second version, and this is someone, athletes that they have more time, but I look at where are the key sessions. And we know that if we can put in a big bike workout midweek, like we talked about, and then again, a big bike workout on Saturday, we're going to do that. And usually our bike workouts now have so much in them that we actually need a little more time to recover. So it works out well for us that coming off the big weekend, by Tuesday, they're not ready to go hard again. They're ready to go hard again on Wednesday. And then we also extend that out. And so, yes, while we are riding on Tuesday. Our longer ride, up to 3 hours, is on Wednesday. And then we push that run workout to Thursday. The swimming, because we went added frequency, we're swimming in this session for the more elite athlete. They're swimming Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. If they swim on Wednesday, it's usually just like some active recovery off what was a big bike. And then sometimes they'll throw in a swim on a Saturday. And then, yeah, we look at if we want to perform on the Wednesday bike workout, the athletes do better in a lead up into that. So there's a Tuesday ride with some little bit of work in order to sharpen for that Wednesday. And we look at it the same on Saturday. On Friday, it's an easy ride, but a little bit of like openers per se. And then, yeah, the runs kind of stay the same. Tuesday, we can go a little bit longer on the run because now it's separate. So like I might have that athlete do that openers bike workout, endurance bike workout, and maybe they can put in 6 to 8 miles on the run with some hill strides or specific fartlek work. And then they don't really run or it's very easy on Wednesday. And then they're ready to turn around and actually put in a quality run on Thursday because of the separating days. So yeah. Those are some ideas on adjusting structure. And then ideally, and the last thing I'm going to say is we're stacking hard days with hard days. And so if we are getting into the gym and we are lifting heavy, it's after like a track workout, right? So that the next day it's easy. We find ourselves with just the average age group athletes. It's like, where can we fit it in where it works routinely? And then they're at least recovering. It might not be ideal, but what is something that can be repeated consistently week in, week out? With the pros, we're optimizing these sessions with load, recovery, load, recovery. That's it?
That's it. Yeah. So I'm having some connection issues now here just towards the last 30 seconds. I don't know if, but it was, you basically sounded like your internet was giving up, but let's continue. Let's press on because now it seems good again.
Okay.
So yeah, at least you're, yeah, it seems good. So, I mean, I have different structures for different levels of frequency. So for example, 2 swims, 2 bikes, 2 runs per week, 3 swims, 3 bikes, 3 runs, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5. And then if there's a mixture, which of course there are lots of mixtures of that, then it kind of ends up being an in-between version. And then even within those different basic frequency structures, there's, do I spread the intensity out more evenly or do I concentrate it more like we talked about before? So I'm definitely not going to read out all of them, but I'm going to read out one that is quite common, which is the 3+3+3 with more evenly distributed intensity. So Monday would be an aerobic swim and Tuesday would be the, so it's basically 1-3-1-2 structure. So 1 day easy, 3 days harder, 1 day easy, 2 days harder. Okay. And hard does not always mean intensity, but it could mean intensity or total volume. So Monday, easy day, aerobic swim. Tuesday, hard bike, easy run. Wednesday, hard swim, easy bike. Thursday, hard run. And a swim that may or may not be intense. So, or it could be moderately intense. You might have done your really hard swim for the week on Wednesday. And then the Thursday swim is still relatively solid, but maybe a step below the one that you did on Wednesday. Because that would also then be a double intensity day. So basically how I view that swim is that it's a secondary intensity day and it's something that I often use for more advanced athletes that are training with this structure, with this template. But for somebody who is maybe more mid-pack or definitely a beginner would be probably just an easy swim. Friday would be a rest day, or this is rest from swim, bike, run because I'm not reading any gym work because that would often be on Monday and Friday, but it would depend a bit on the athlete's availability. I'm happy to move those things around. So rest from swim, bike, run, and Saturday bike, which would be a longer bike, and certainly towards the racing, when we get closer to race, that would also have race-specific intensity in it. And it might, for an advanced athlete, it might also have some, or it might have intensity in the general preparation. And same thing with the run, Sunday run, longer run, and which would have potentially intensity, potentially just be an aerobic run. So that gives you basically 9 workouts, 3 across each discipline, and one of each that is definitely going to be an intense one, and one of each that is one that I can potentially use depending on the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. I was just, as you were speaking on the structure, it's so funny how many ways you can do things.
Yeah.
How many different, like within my athletes, I mentioned two key ones, but I literally have like four or five different ones in the way we do it. One that does come to mind and one that I always enjoyed was I always could only do one hard day. I went all in on that day. And then the next day, I could do the volume, but it needed to be easy, aerobic, supportive. And then I was ready to go the next day. And so in that, I would always do like the key hard session was Tuesday on the bike. The key hard session on Thursday was the run. And then the key big Saturday, right? And then around those were pretty much swim, bike, and run every day, but just like supportive volume, setting myself up for that next key day.
Yeah. So. What this week would look like with more concentrated intensity would be instead of the bike run on Tuesday, it would be swim bike. So the Wednesday, which had the hard swim and the easy bike, that would go on Tuesday, but it would be hard swim, hard bike.
Yeah.
And the Tuesday that had the hard bike and easy run would go on the Wednesday, but it would be easy bike, easy run. So Tuesday would be a hard day, double intensity. Wednesday would be just volume day. And Thursday would be the swim run. So that would, again, potentially be a double intensity day, or maybe the swim would be a bit more moderate and the run would be the intense. But in the double intensity structure, then it would be a double intensity day with a hard swim and a hard run. And then the Saturday would be a harder bike and hard run. And then maybe, but then that means you're adding a fourth bike, for example. So that would go on a Sunday as a longer bike or even a fourth run. But you would have another potential double intensity day there on the Saturday. Which could be a brick session as well. But yeah, let's do one more because we're actually going quite long here.
Yeah.
See here. This one, Smug Pies asks, I can't swim often. What's the best cross training alternative if I already run and bike a lot?
Ooh. That's a tough one. And there's nothing that can replace feel for the water. Like actually getting into the water. Like I know I have so many athletes that they use like the Vasa machine and some use bands effectively, but it's those are athletes that have built up. Some have a swim background and they're just kind of going through the movements of, and the, you know, they're building up strength in the gym just to keep the muscular strength there and endurance for the swim. Yeah, I'd be curious your answer. I can't say, think of a replicant other than being able to get into the pool that's really significantly going to help your swim, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, what I would do is I would try to, I would see if perhaps I would use many months during the winter where the athlete wouldn't have to swim at all, and then see if we can get two consistent swims a week just for 8 weeks leading into a race.
Yeah.
And if there's a possibility to, yeah, to sacrifice swimming for a large part of the season, but making it happen consistently leading into the race. If that's possible, I think that would be ideal. Yeah, otherwise, like you said, it's you can't really replace swimming. I do use things like, or I would prescribe things like stretch cords, potentially. I would do that, but yeah, it's not going to, definitely not going to be the same. I would lean into what we talked about before about, or what I said about focusing on the strengths. So even if he's already running and biking a lot, he's probably not biking as much as Tadej Pogacar. So there's probably still if your time is fixed and you could potentially just replace that time that you're not swimming with biking more, because biking wouldn't add a significant injury risk. So, and making the bike even more of a weapon than it might already be. So yeah, I think, yeah, trying to do the best with the bike and the run instead. And cross training for swimming. Yeah. Don't have much experience with Vasa. The Sen 8 swim trainer is basically stretch cords, but in a horizontal position. So a little bit more specific. But I mean, still, it's not the same as, I wouldn't try to force cross training, basically. I would try to either schedule swimming strategically or just work with what we have and optimize the bike and the run.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm glad you said it like that, but because I get that question all the time of like, should I add this discipline and this discipline to help me? I'm like, no, bike and run more, rather than doing something random that really doesn't cross over as much as you think.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm glad you said that.
I was even thinking when I saw this question about cross-country skiing, because I mean, you do get some similarities in terms of the triceps, but it's just a completely different movement pattern. So I don't think it actually helps.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, your thought where you said also like, hey, maybe just don't swim. You don't want to swim, but hey, commit these final 8 weeks to swimming. That would be the way to go. I keep remembering how like after COVID, when we didn't have a pool and we built up all this fitness and then we lost and it felt awful for like 2 to 3 weeks. But honestly, by like the third, fourth week, like I was like, okay, like it's back. I feel good again. And so I do feel once you do commit to swimming closer to the race, like you can make the gains, some decent gains. It's not obviously going to be as much as had you just kept swimming, but at least you're going to be in a position to be able to race from doing it that way.
For me, it took longer. I can't remember exactly, but I think it must have been at a minimum 6 weeks until I started feeling close to, but I didn't feel back to where I was, but I started to feel like I wasn't terrible at swimming. And I had this discussion in a call just before we got on our call with one of my athletes about how this individual differences in how time out from swimming affects different people differently. I definitely think that the more experience you have swimming, the more you're like a collegiate swimmer, former collegiate swimmer is going to be able to swim really well even after 10 years out of the pool. But but still within people with the same background, there's also individual differences there, I feel. But 8 weeks should 6 to 8 weeks should capture, you know, quite a you can get by with that, I feel.
Yeah.
And it's if you have to do some big commitment, like longer commute, it's still a short enough time period that it might be doable.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
All right. Well, I think that's just about it for today. Thank you so much for coming on, Natasha. It was really great to chat to you. And you're on NVDM Coaching is your coaching business. And so nvdmcoaching.com and at NVDM Coaching on social media and YouTube. You have a good YouTube channel with lots of instructional videos. So that's recommended for listeners to check out. Is there anything else that you have going on that you want to mention?
Yeah, just as far as videos and instruction, my personal Instagram actually has a lot as well. I post a lot of swim tips, actually. And so it's NatashaVDM81 is my personal Instagram. And then you mentioned the NVDM coaching. And then, the only other thing that we caught up on since, we said 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years.
Was just that I've been fortunate enough to be a part of the Raw Endurance team. So Raw Nutrition is a supplement company that is now in the endurance space. We sponsor athletes like, Kat Matthews and Martin Van Riel and Daniel Backergaard, Lydia Russell. We just talked about her, for example, Jackie Herring. But anyway, it's been really fun to be a part of that team, bringing just a new endurance supplement into the space that we are very passionate about. We really built it off the needs of our athletes. And you think about, flavor profile, as well as what's in the product. But then finally, like the big one that hits is the cost of the product. We, before making this product, everyone was complaining how expensive it was to go and fuel their 5-6 hour rides when we're trying to like have them experiment with like 120 grams of carbs, et cetera. And we're like, okay, well, we're going to solve that issue for them. So that was something that I was fortunate enough to be a part of that's in the last 3 years.
Very cool. And coaching some very good athletes. So the season is coming up. Hope that they're all doing well and have a successful season ahead of them.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you as well. I know you work with a ton of amazing athletes. So good luck to you. It's always an exciting time for us to come off the off season, all the work that's been done, and then see it all pay off. Hopefully come March, April, and then the rest.
Let's hope so. Thank you so much. And hope to speak to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Sounds good. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. As always, you can find detailed show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and links and resources mentioned will be in the show notes and in the episode description in your podcast app. And also a reminder that I always put a list of related episodes in the episode description. So episodes that you are likely to enjoy a lot if you enjoyed this one, because they have some sort of connection or similarity between them. So check that out. And especially if you're somebody who runs out of podcasts to listen to, then going through those recommended related episodes from the different episodes that you are listening to on that Triathlon show is a good way to make sure that you never run out of content. We'll be back next week with another episode. I don't have 100% clear yet which one that will be, but stay subscribed if you are subscribed, or subscribe if you're not already subscribed. And that way you'll see it next Thursday when it is published. And remember as well that you can find the podcast on YouTube now as a video podcast if you prefer watching to listening. And as per usual, I want to remind you that if you need any help with taking your triathlon to the next level, if you have any goals that you're working towards and they are important to you, you want to do the best that you can to achieve them, and or just in general, you want to improve as an athlete, then remember that we have a lot of different options to help you achieve those goals, become a better athlete, ranging from individual coaching to ready-made training plans and customized training plans. And we also do one-off consultations, which a lot of athletes find really useful if you want to still be self-coaching, but have some outside objectivity, having a look at what you're doing and getting some external input, which can be really valuable, even if you are the one holding the reins, so to say. But I want to read a review that we got recently in our feedback form that we send out to athletes when they stop working with us. This is important. We don't send it out when athletes achieve their best ever race performance. We send it out when athletes actually stop working with us, so we get honest feedback. So one of the questions that is more general is, how was it being coached by your coach? And this review is from Olivia, or this answer to the question is from Olivia, who's answering, "I really enjoyed working with coach. He was very professional in all aspects and was very easy to form a great coach-athlete relationship with. He pays a lot of attention to detail. I was constantly learning throughout the coaching period, and he went beyond my expectation of a coach." So that's just to give you a bit of an idea what it might be like to work with a coach. And even though coaching is different from customized plans and training plans and so on, we do strive for that same level of professionalism and detail orientation in all of our services. So regardless of what you would consider, I think that's a bit of social proof of what we offer. And if you're interested, check out more information, of course, on scientifictriathlon.com, or email me directly and we can discuss what options might be the best for you and how to move forward with any of that. But all right, that's about it for today. I hope your training is going really well, and thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.